Hello everyone and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
Democrats should unify behind whoever is the candidate. They shouldn't be worried.
Amid the noise about electability, Nobel economist Paul Krugman tells me why it doesn't matter which top Democrat wins the nomination. Then, Trump's Middle East peace plan falls flat. So what next for U.S. foreign policy? Kim Guttas, author of Black Wave, on the ongoing Iran-Saudi battle to dominate the region. Plus,
I don't ultimately see a situation where you have any kind of seismic shift in the insurance programs that are available to Americans.
Healthcare is the number one election issue for voters. But the Washington Post Paige Winfield Cunningham tells our Hari Srinivasan neither party will make major changes.
Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour in New York, and the 2020 election season is off to the races. With its first major contest in Iowa wrapping up, voters are revealing which topics they care about most and who they think can address them. Among the top concerns is, as always, the economy. Under President Trump, wages are up, unemployment is down, and the stock market is booming, which he's banking on to win re-election. And while all campaigns harken back to the famous Clinton adage that it's the economy, stupid, Democrats have a wide choice of candidate from center-left to further-left. Amid all the angst over that choice and who can beat Trump, my first guest tonight has a surprising new insight. Nobel laureate and New York Times columnist Paul Krugman tells me that when it comes to actual economic policy, it won't matter much which Democrat wins the nomination. Paul Krugman, welcome back to the program.
Good to be on.
So, you wrote a very surprising op-ed. Your most recent one in the New York Times was about, in a sense, it doesn't matter which Democrat wins or which front runner wins the caucus because the policies necessarily won't change. You said, in terms of actual policy, it probably doesn't matter who the Democrats nominate. If you're a centrist worried about the gigantic spending increases Sanders has proposed, calm down because they won't happen. If you're a progressive worried that Biden might govern like a Republican, you should also calm down because he wouldn't. That is that cynical, pragmatic, hopeful? What?
I think it's pragmatic and hopeful. I mean, the Democrat Party these days is solidly progressive. It's what Europeans would call a social democratic party, and that's true even of the people we call centrists. They are, in fact, prepared to move policy significantly towards more inclusion, expanded health care, and so on. And on the other hand, there is a left wing of the Democratic Party that would like to follow more radical policies, and we can argue about whether or not those would be a good thing. But the country won't back those. There isn't a President Sanders would not be able to get the really expensive items in his agenda through the Senate, even if Democrats take the Senate.
So even if Democrats take the Senate?
Even if Democrats take the Senate. There are enough Democrats, Democratic senators, you know, think of Joe Manchin at one end, but there are sort of enough Democratic senators that something that call for really massive increases in spending and large middle class tax increases is not going to happen. So I think that if you're worried about, I mean, I'm trying to talk to both sides here. I think the people who are, you know, alarmed by Sanders, all right, I actually don't think his policies would be that terrible, even if he could implement them, but he can't. So that's not going to happen. And anybody who thinks that the Democratic Party is going to be, you know, Paul Ryan in disguise, it's not going to happen.
So let me ask you this, because are you being political, or rather, are you trying to address this big conundrum that Democrats around the country seem to have, and that is who is electable? Are you basically saying, if you guys are trying to make a calculation about who's electable, don't, because they're all electable and their policies economically are pretty much will end up the same?
Actually, no. Electability is something I worry about quite a lot, though I don't know the answer. But I'm much more worried about the hay that Republicans might make over Sanders' proposals than about his program itself. The Sanders agenda in its full form is not going to happen, but he hasn't really been vetted on it by his fellow Democrats. And so what would happen during the campaign if Sanders is the candidate worries me quite a lot. We don't know this. The polling right now really doesn't show anything very strong. But I have to say, I have some anxiety that, you know, Republicans accuse anyone who wants to make life better of being a socialist. But in Sanders, you would have somebody who actually says, I am a socialist, although it's not true. He's, in fact, just a social democrat. So that I think it's not an electability argument. It's actually, my argument is that Democrats should unify behind whoever is the candidate. They shouldn't be worried.
And why do you think they might not unify behind? What worries you about that? Surely they would. They want to beat Trump.
Well, there is one wing of the party of people who are, you know, are relatively conservative, if you like. It's a sort of a Bloomberg wing or whatever of the party. I don't think it's that many people, but it's a significant part of the donor base that is, you know, alarmed by highly progressive policies. They might sit on their hands. And then there's the Bernie people who are sort of perfection or nothing. It's got to be our guy, and who might be tempted to. I mean, we have seen some Bernie surrogates, you know, claiming that Joe Biden has endorsed Paul Ryan's budget policies, which is not true. But I worry that they might that we might have some opting out on that side of the Democrats. And the fact of the matter is, everyone who's a Democrat should understand that what you're going to get is a significant but not huge progressive shift in U.S. policies if any Democrat wins.
And just quickly outline what that looks like, a significant but not huge progressive shift.
It means for sure greatly enhanced Obamacare, maybe with a buy-in to Medicare as part of it, but certainly something that would get another 15, 20 million people insured. It means increased taxes on the rich, whether it's a full, you know, Elizabeth Warren wealth tax or something more modest, but certainly increased taxes on the rich. It means increased spending on families. We're going to see a lot of movement towards child care and relatively cheap but hugely important policies that affect children. So those are the things that are going to happen whoever wins.
I think yourself and many others in your field of economics predicted that a Trump economy would not be good for the country.
Actually, no. I made a bad call on election night, but I retracted that call 3 days later.
Okay, the call and the retraction.
The call was, I said, oh, we're going to have a recession because we have a terrible group of people and markets are going to lose confidence. And then 3 days later, I said, you know, I let myself fall into motivated reasoning. And the reality is that what Trump is likely to do is run bigger budget deficits, and that bigger budget deficits are going to provide some economic stimulus, which is what has in fact happened. I mean, the budget deficit now is about $300 billion a year, bigger than it would have been if we hadn't had the Trump policies enacted.
And, and the corporate tax cuts, you're specifically talking about.
The corporate tax cuts, about half of that. And then individual tax cuts and a little bit of extra spending, too. But mostly corporate and wealthy tax cuts. It's lousy stimulus, but it's stimulus.
Okay, so with that being the point, and President Trump going around the world as Davos and around the country at his rallies, basically talking up the great American economy. And people believe it. I've heard many people in Davos love his economy. Many people around the country love his economy. Isn't it going to be very hard to argue, come the general election, that the economy is not better?
Oh, the economy is better. The question is whether it's enough. I mean, Trump's approval is way lower than you might expect given the state of the economy. And, I mean, there's a lesson here. Democrats, Obama tried to be fiscally responsible, and no good deed goes unpunished. It was also true that he was constrained by a Republican Congress. But all that fiscal austerity that was the consensus of that we had to do during the Obama years turns out to have done, you know, nothing but harm. It just restrained the economy. And now we're having a deficit palooza under Trump, and it's all, you know, it boosts the economy. Now, mm-hmm. I think Democrats shouldn't try to argue that the economy is lousy. They should try to argue that, look, if we're going to run a deficit, if we're going to run a trillion-dollar deficit, maybe we should do it for something useful, actually be repairing the country's infrastructure.
Which Trump said he wanted to do.
Yes, but he was never going to do it. That was one of the columns I wrote right after the election was saying that there will never be a Trump infrastructure plan, and there hasn't.
Is James Carville's famous four-word slogan, "Is the economy stupid," still relevant today?
Probably not. If we look at actual politics, there's some evidence, even from the statistics. I talked to political scientists that the relationship between the economy and the vote is weaker than it used to be, and it was never as strong as legend has it. And also, it's
really
the, yeah.
I mean, that is
it's real, but it's not. It's not.
It's
everything.
Like accepted wisdom.
Yeah, but it's exaggerated. There's actually a lot of other stuff that goes in, and also it's the rate of change of the economy. In the year or so before the election that matters. So tell me what's going to happen over the next few quarters, and I'll have a better idea. The growth that we saw most recently, 2.1%, that is not the kind of growth that it leads to a massive electoral
It's also
triumph.
Not what the president promised. As a campaigner, right. He promised 4 to 6% growth.
Yeah. What? Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And what we actually got was 1 year of 2.9, a second year of 2.3. And that's not a whole lot, really, when all is said and done, for all of that deficit spending.
What about the actual people? It says in your own newspaper, The New York Times, the Iowa population aptly reflects the graying of the American economy. Metropolitan areas are prospering, rural ones are not so much, like in agriculture and all the rest of it. And that's not just in Iowa, it's around the country, apparently. What does that mean for people, particularly in rural states, who we were told in the 2016 election were being left behind and Trump was going to rescue them? But it says here that they're not prospering.
No, it's actually what's really striking about the Trump economy is that while overall performance has been pretty good, the parts that are performing badly are exactly the parts that Trump said he was going to boost. So farmers are hurting hard, badly from his trade policies. Manufacturing is actually in a recession. He promised to revive manufacturing. We had this massive corporate tax cut and business investment is down. And it's all being powered by deficit spending and consumer spending. So you would think that there would be some significant defections. It's not clear because there's a lot of other things that are going on that are motivating people.
Your new book is called Arguing with Zombies. Right. What specifically do you mean about that?
A zombie idea is any idea that should have been killed by evidence but keeps on shambling along eating people's brains. And so the biggest zombie in American politics is the idea that tax cuts pay for themselves. But the second biggest and ultimately the much more important is climate denial. And we have a majority of Republicans in Congress simply deny that climate change is happening. Of those who admit that maybe something is happening, essentially all of them oppose any significant action to do something about it.
The IMF and many others talk about how the fossil fuel industry might not even exist if it wasn't for the enormous amount of tax benefits, out-and-out cash injections, tax incentives and subsidies.
And not being required to pay the cost of the damage it inflicts. Mm-hmm. Even if you leave aside climate change, the health costs and the economic costs of air pollution created by burning fossil fuels is enormous. It's really, if you take the U.S. fossil fuel sector, it basically, once you take account of these things, it basically destroys about twice as much value added as the value of the industry. So it's a zombie industry. If we had appropriate pricing and didn't have these subsidies, most of the fossil fuel sector would just go away.
So what do you say? Obviously, you are for the greening of the economy.
Yeah.
And globally, it looks like that's what should happen. What do you say, though, to voters in Pennsylvania, a key swing state where fracking exists, and even the lieutenant governor, who's a Democrat, has said, a Democrat who comes in like Bernie or Elizabeth Warren, who says we're going to ban fracking overnight, is basically saying we're going to ban your jobs overnight. And somebody like Biden, who comes in and says, yes, it needs to be changed, but it has to be done, carefully and with the correct view of people's jobs and livelihood. What do you say about that?
I would say that climate change is a massive cumulative problem. So you don't have to fix everything on day one. Mm-hmm. So it's okay to have a transition. And it's also really important to package the climate change, package restrictions on fossil fuels with job-creating programs. A Green New Deal is a great idea, not just because there's a pretty good economic case for a lot of investment, mm-hmm. but also because it means that it's not just eat your spinach. It's also here's some you know, people say it'll be a Christmas tree with something for everybody. Well, yes, it would, and that's a good thing. So I'm for a sort of broad based and somewhat gradualist approach, just because that's the only way we're going to get this done.
So that's really interesting, because it's not what the very far left of the party is saying. And obviously young people like Greta Thunberg and young people in this country and many others want a right now approach to it.
I mean, they're right on the substance. Every year that we don't stop greenhouse gas emissions is contributing significantly to the future. But on the other hand, one more year is not going to be make or break for the planet. And it's much more important that we get moving on addressing climate change than that we do it the perfectly right way.
Now, you have basically written a lot in your book and elsewhere in your columns and in interviews about the Republicans' bad faith on this issue. You've obviously probably read the article that Sebastian Mallaby, an economics correspondent, has written for The Atlantic. Cool it, Krugman, he says. He basically says, and he takes issue with what you say, Republicans don't just have bad ideas. At this point, they are necessarily bad people. He's basically saying if you sweep everybody into that one basket, you are forfeiting the ability to influence even the Republicans. And you're not making a distinction between Republican rank and file people or, you know, the vested interests, the leadership who are climate deniers.
No, I think Mallaby actually is the one who failed to make the distinction. I thought I was pretty clear in saying that I'm talking about the professional politicians. And basically anybody with any principles has been driven out of the Republican Party as a professional politician. Now, if we look at all of the people in America who say that they are Republicans, there is a lot of flexibility there. There are quite a few people who don't adhere to the party line. One of the funny things is actually that less informed Republican voters often have more sensible views than well-informed Republican voters, because they don't know what the party line is supposed to be. So I think the chance of reaching out to a number of people who think that they are Republicans is real, and I wouldn't be insulting them. But the chance of reaching out to any Republican member of the House, any Republican member of the Senate, is minimal. You're just not going to get. So that's the distinction you need to make.
But what about the numbers in terms of voters? I mean, we see the number of Republicans, let's say on campus and elsewhere, who believe in man-made climate change and that something needs to be done about it, is increasing. We see what voters are, you know, saying about this issue. It is a voting issue for young people, both on both sides. What will make, you know, the people who you despair of, the leaders, change?
Oh, I think nothing short of repeated massive electoral defeat. They're just very, very powerful incentives. Anyone who breaks ranks is going to see his or her political career destroyed and her post-political career destroyed as well, because all of the consulting opportunities will go away. So it's going to have to come. What really comes down is you have to convince these relatively conservative voters, who, however, do care about climate change, that voting Republican is ensuring that nothing will be done. I mean, it was interesting. Greg Mankiw, center-right economist, former chairman of Bush's Council of Economic Advisors, recently declared that he can no longer call himself a Republican because of climate change. And that's good for him. He's at least acknowledging reality there.
So I want to ask you this, because, again, one of the items in this, I found it fascinating reading the research. I found it fascinating that you yourself came out of university talking about being a technocrat.
Yeah.
And, in fact, I never knew that you worked in the Reagan White House trying to, bring facts. I think by technocrat you meant facts and evidence in the economy rather than politics.
Yes, I was the senior international economist in the Reagan Council of Economic Advisors, sub-political level. The senior domestic economist was a guy named, what was his name? Larry Summers. Don't know what happened to him. So,
well, that's interesting.
Yeah. But that was...
So what happened? What happened? Because you have become much more political. You occupy a very important place in not only in the New York Times, obviously, as a columnist, but in progressive politics.
Well, partly it is that I have a different job now. You know, writing economic reports inside the government and writing newspaper columns is a very different thing. But it's also the Republican Party itself has changed. I mean, even in the Reagan years, there was a lot more flexibility, a lot more openness to ideas. The process of zombification, the zombie ideas taking over the party, was already underway, but it had not gotten as far as it has now. So there were still a lot of reasonable Republicans in the Senate and House in the 1980s. There aren't any now.
Well, on that categoric statement,
yeah.
Paul Krugman, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
Well, thank you.
Now, the Democratic candidates are united on a major foreign policy issue, rejecting the recently revealed Trump Middle East peace plan. Some even writing a letter to the White House demanding the U.S. does nothing to jeopardize a two-state solution, preventing any unilateral moves by either side there. Arab leaders, including key Trump allies, have also unanimously rejected it with a sharp statement from the Arab League this weekend. Let's get straight to what comes next with journalist Kim Kattas. She's been covering the Middle East for the past 20 years, and her new book is called Black Wave, about the enduring 40-year rivalry between Iran and Saudi Arabia and America's place in the region. She's joining me now from Washington. Kim Kattas, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me, Christiane.
So, Kim, it's great to be able to talk to you, particularly with this, you know, sort of primer, if you like, your book that it's come out at this very important time. Because this weekend in the region, the foreign ministers from the Arab League got together and unanimously rejected the peace plan. What does that mean for, I guess, the U.S. influence over that region and the ability to finally get some kind of end to this enduring, huge problem between the Israelis and the Palestinians?
Well, it's more than a problem, of course. Palestinians continue to live under occupation for the most part. What it says about, the U.S. foreign policy in the region is that I think President Trump chose his time very well to put this peace plan forward. Because although the Arab League put out this very sharp statement stating that they rejected this Middle East plan, I would think that it's really mostly lip service. Because, A, they know that their own people are not only tired of the fact that nothing ever seems to go right with the Arab-Israeli conflict in favor of the Arabs and the Palestinians, but they're also too consumed by the upheaval and oppression in their own countries, whether you live under the dictatorship of Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, or whether you live in the Syrian civil war, or whether you live in Yemen or in Baghdad. So Arab leaders know that they can pay lip service to the cause, but in private, what they're mostly concerned about, particularly in the case of Saudi Arabia, is the role of Iran in the region, and they need the Trump administration to help them continue to curb and contain Iran. So in private, I suspect the conversations are very different between Arab leaders and the Trump administration. What is interesting is that although countries like Saudi Arabia are focused on keeping on staying on Trump's good side because they're concerned about Iran, this Trump peace plan provides an opportunity for the Iranians, because everyone pays lip service to the Palestinian cause, including the Iranians. And they've been doing that ever since Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini in the 70s came back to Iran and became the supreme leader and tried to use the Palestinian cause to pose as the leader who could reach beyond the borders of Iran and the Shia community and succeed where Arab leaders had failed.
Yeah, I mean, that's really interesting. And I wonder, I mean, what Iranian leaders might do given this. And I'm going to ask you that for a second. But I'm really fascinated by what you say, that Arab leaders are, quote unquote, paying lip service to the Palestinians with their unanimous declaration from the Arab League meeting. And the U.S. Democrats are also criticizing it, as I said. Let me just read a little bit of their statement, letter to the White House. Unilateral U.S. endorsement of Israeli sovereignty throughout Jerusalem over all Israeli settlements in the West Bank and the Jordan Valley guarantees Palestinian rejection and paves the way for full or partial Israeli annexation of the West Bank. Such a development would disregard international law, engender opposition from our allies, and undermine existing U.S. policy. So very quickly, Do you agree that this plan undermines existing U.S. policy and, you know, to an extent, international U.N. law on the issue?
There are two ways of looking at it. Yes, it undermines international law because annexation of occupied territory is illegal under international law. But a lot of people in the Arab world will tell you that although it looks as though, and Democrats say that this undermines U.S. policy, the reality on the ground, as Palestinians feel it and as a lot of Arabs feel it, is that the U.S. has never really stood up for Palestinian rights, has never been a fair arbiter in this mediation, and that what President Trump is doing is simply removing the fig leaf and weighing all on the side of the Israelis.
Well, to that point, then, I'm going to play you a little bit of an interview that I had with Jared Kushner, who is the architect, along with some other close Trump allies, of this plan. And interesting that he also talks about Arab reaction to this. Just take a listen.
When I was with the Sultan of Oman, he said something to me that really resonated, where he said, I feel bad for the Palestinian people that they carry the burden with them of the entire Muslim world. And it made me really understand that this is two different conflicts that have been conflated, that people have used for their own different purposes over the years, never for good. You have a territorial dispute between the Israelis and the Palestinians and a security dispute. There's a very prescriptive outcome that we propose for that. If the Palestinians have issues with that, they should try to come and negotiate it.
So is he correct in the analysis of what the Arabs think, in the prescription that they have offered? And to your point about how the Arab nations are fed up with all of this, what happens next? I mean, they may be fed up, they may be paying lip service to their street, but what exactly does that mean for the future of this conflict?
Well, the Palestinians have said that they're going to cut security cooperation with the Israelis. That has consequences. Mm-hmm. Israelis who oppose this Trump plan are concerned about the future of their country as a democracy. They don't seem to think that this is a peace plan. They think, you know, Israeli commentators have said that this is a surrender. These are surrender terms for the Palestinians. But we'll have to see how things unfold. But as I said, I do think that Arab countries like Saudi Arabia are mostly concerned about staying on the good side of President Trump, because their foremost concern at the moment is their enmity with Iran and trying to contain Iran's regional ambitions. And as we've been saying, you know, everyone uses that conflict to their advantage. Remember that Iran, as part of its Islamic Revolutionary Guards, has an outfit, a regional paramilitary force called Al-Quds Force, named after Jerusalem in Arabic, Al-Quds. And the head of that paramilitary force was, until very recently, Qasem Soleimani, who somehow thought that the road to Jerusalem had to go through Beirut, Baghdad, and Aleppo in Syria.
I get the irony in your voice right there. But so with the assassination of Qasem Soleimani, does that make Iran's position stronger or weaker in the region? And given the fact that, yes, Saudi Arabia and the Gulf nations and others are battling for dominance and influence in there and believe that Trump is the person to be on side for that, where is that really headed in this post-Soleimani reality?
You know, I would say that the Iranians are very good at capitalizing on moments of weakness and vulnerability and turning it to their advantage. If you'll remember that after the 2003 U.S. invasion of Iraq, there was a lot of fear in Tehran that they could be next. And they used that moment to really go into Iraq and flood it with their allies, their proxy militias. And here we are today, where Iran really has the ultimate say in many ways in the politics of Iraq, which is why people are also protesting in Baghdad against Iran's stranglehold on the country and the country's politics. And they're doing the same across the region now after the assassination of Qasem Soleimani. They're really trying to capitalize on this moment and turn a moment of weakness and vulnerability into a moment of strength, in particular because to some extent the U.S. has moved on. President Trump ordered the strike, and then, you know, the administration to some extent has taken its eyes off the ball.
So let me ask you this then. You can imagine that, I assume, within the Trump administration and certainly amongst the analysts of all of this, people, some of them are saying, well, this encounter has revealed Iran to be a paper tiger, that it talks a tough game, that everybody thought there was going to be some massive outbreak of hostilities in the region. But after the Soleimani assassination, that nothing has happened and Iran is essentially, you know, quiet. What do you think Iran's next move is, and what do you think of that analysis?
I would disagree with that. I would say that Iran continues to do what it's always done, is move very strategically and very quietly. It is trying to put down the protests in Iraq. You know, more than 500 people have died in the crackdown on these protests. It has had to face protests in Iran itself and has been using violence against protesters there. And in Lebanon, in my own country, it has, as I said, capitalized on this moment of weakness to try to not only solidify its position in the country through the work of its ally, Hezbollah, militant group, but also a political movement, but push even further and have a real say in the government there. So I think we'll continue to see very strategic political moves and more moves through its proxy militias in the region, including in Iraq.
Now, your book is called Black Wave, and its subtitle is about the 40-year rivalry that unraveled the Middle East and between Iran and Saudi Arabia. As we've established, Saudi Arabia enjoys the support of the Trump administration and many others who believe that the ultimate aim in the region is to confront Iran. Given the fact that nobody came to Saudi Arabia's aid after the Iranians, we believe, attacked the oil facility and the infrastructure so dramatically last year. How much can Saudi Arabia rely on the United States? And particularly as you hear President Trump not really wanting to go to full-scale war and not having, you know, come to Saudi's rescue, really.
I would say two things here, Christian. First of all, yes, I think the Saudis were worried after the attack on Saudi oil facilities in September, because there was a lot of heat but no fire from the Trump administration. But the Trump administration did then beef up the numbers of U.S. troops in the region. And that's why the Saudis tried to see whether they could engage in indirect talks with the Iranians through countries like Pakistan and Iran. And that is a pattern. So Saudi Arabia wants Iran contained and maybe even beaten up, but they don't want to go through an escalation. And after the Qasem Soleimani assassination, it was the same thing. The Saudis rushed to try to move towards de-escalation because they don't want an all-out war. They want to stay on Trump's good side. They want more actions to contain Iran, but they do not want to fight a full-on war. What I would say is that it's important to look not only at Iran's actions or Saudi Arabia's actions, but to really look at the rivalry between them and how that dynamic over the last 40 years has become part of a triangle with the U.S. You cannot only look at one or the other. You have to look at this triangle, this dynamic that includes the United States. And that's what I try to explore in Black Wave, in my book, because I do think that the rivalry between Saudi Arabia and Iran is also very damaging to the region. And we have a tendency, and particularly American foreign policy makers have a tendency of looking at the two countries separately, and they need to look at them together.
So finally, I want to ask you, because, you know, one of the questions you ask in your book is what happened to us? In other words, Arab states, Arab people, what happened to us? And you talk about a lot of young people or civilians who have made it their business, whether it's in Saudi Arabia or in Iraq or other places, as you call it, the silent majority, the more progressives, the people who want to promote democracy and presumably felt that the Arab Spring might do that. But then, as analysts and reviewers have pointed out, you know, the people who you profile, for instance, Jamal Khashoggi, a good friend of yours, they are no longer around. So what happened to us is a question that many, many people are trying to have answered. Why is the Arab nation, the people, the street, unable to get beyond a very, very authoritarian system?
Well, part of the reason, as I pointed out just now in my previous answer, is this rivalry between Saudi Arabia and Iran, this sort of all-consuming a fight for dominance of the region, in which the U.S. plays often an aggravating role. But the rivalry, which started in 1979, has gone on for four decades. It's a rivalry in which both countries use all tools at their disposal, including cultural, religious, and social. And it has transformed the region to the extent that we don't even recognize ourselves. Because I know the question has been asked before, what went wrong? I try to answer it from our perspective in the region, looking at how things have changed and why, and what role each one of these two countries, Iran and Saudi Arabia, have played in the unraveling. But you're right that a lot of the people who have tried to fight back against this black wave of intolerance and the rise of militancy have either gone into exile or have paid with their lives, like Jamal Khashoggi. But there are more than 350 million people in the region, because I explore also, actually there are more, because I go from Egypt all the way to Pakistan. And I think that when you look at the protests in Iraq today, in Lebanon, and in Iran, you can see very clearly that people do not want to be hostages anymore to the ghosts of 1979, a year that has changed everything in the region.
With the rise of political Islam. Kim Ghattas, thank you so much indeed. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Now, when it comes to the November election in the United States, health care is the number one issue for voters in both parties. Paige Winfield Cunningham is a national reporter at The Washington Post, and she focuses specifically on health care policy. And despite the health care wars within the Democratic Party and also between Democrats and the GOP, Cunningham tells our Hari Srinivasan that neither party will make major changes to insurance policies.
Since we're thinking about Iowa tonight, does someone in, say, Dubuque have the same access to health care as someone in D.C.?
It's been almost 10 years since the Affordable Care Act was passed, that landmark health care reform law. But there have been some things along the way which have actually hindered the law. And so we haven't reached the uninsured rate that we had the insured rate that we had hoped for when Congress was passing the law. And so it sort of varies by state. Some states accepted the law's Medicaid expansion. And so we have a lot of wide variation in terms of health insurance, public health insurance programs that are available for people state by state. Certainly, the issue is a really important one for Iowa voters. I think it ranks above even removing Trump from office or climate change in terms of what Iowa voters are worried about.
Yeah.
And you really have seen that in a lot of the conversations on the campaign trail that the candidates are having.
That health care, it still matters to them. Is there, you know, there's also been a number of stories, including from The Washington Post, on how rural hospitals are suffering in a different way, that there's basically, obviously, geography is a problem for if you're in rural Kansas or rural Iowa, you have to drive farther. But then now if those few hospitals start to close down, you're really going pretty far if you're not going across state lines. And that could actually just affect something as simple as an ambulance getting to you.
Absolutely. So that question of healthcare access has really come to the forefront as the candidates have talked about Medicare for All.
Yeah.
Because you're right, right now in a lot of rural communities, we do have provider shortages. That's been a problem we've had for a long time. But you've really seen hospitals mobilize with a lot of other providers against this idea of Medicare for All. And what they're saying is that because Medicare pays at so much of a lower rate than what the private insurers reimburse for, that if you go to a single payer system where all of a sudden all of their patients are covered under a single government plan, yeah, they're going to be facing big payment cuts. I mean, I think studies have shown Medicare often pays only 50% or even less than what private plans do for inpatient and outpatient procedures. But then at the same time, our reporters have looked at healthcare systems in other countries that do have more of a single payer type of a system, yeah, and found that they don't have those shortages necessarily. If you go to Canada, they have a much more expansive system where people have a basic coverage and then they can buy private coverage for supplemental things, prescription drug coverage and dental, but they sort of have this basic guaranteed coverage. And, you know, those reimbursement rates are certainly lower for providers, and yet we don't see those shortages necessarily.
But where do the candidates now, at least the top-tier candidates, stand on this? Because early on in the campaigns, it seemed like everyone was for Medicare for all. Now, Bernie Sanders seems to be the only one still sticking to it because he's been talking about it for a long, long time.
Right. It was so buzzy last year. I mean, even as a health policy reporter, even I was surprised at how excited and the candidates seemed to be about it. I think a big reason, though, was because, you know, it was early on in their campaigns. They hadn't really taken the time to look closely at what do they mean by Medicare for all. So, you know, on one hand, yes, you have Bernie. He's been thinking about this for a really long time. He had initially proposed his Medicare for all bill several years ago and then came out with a second additional version of it. And he's really spent the time to think about, you know, what services should be covered. You know, should we have co-pays or deductibles? He's come out proposing a very, very generous plan. And I think that Democrats really liked his plan initially because it kind of goes to that idea they all embrace, which is universal coverage, bringing the country to a place where everybody has coverage. You know, we're still kind of stuck in this place where 27 million Americans still lack health insurance even after the Affordable Care Act.
Right.
So how do you get there? And, you know, the thing that all these Dems share in common is the idea that everybody should have coverage. But what you saw last year is as the candidates started thinking about what it would look like, as they started looking at how the issue polls among voters and the tough questions that really come up when you talk about a single payer system, a lot of them kind of started softening their approach, kind of walking it back a little bit to where you're right now. I think Sanders would be the only candidate who is still really promising that this is something he would try to really accomplish immediately upon becoming president.
And was what happened to Elizabeth Warren kind of a cautionary tale for them to say, OK, well, here she is. She's for this idea. Now, when she's pressed on it, she's not as stridently in support of it as she used to be.
Yeah, I would say I think the candidate that was the most forward thinking or the most foresightful on this was probably Mayor Pete Buttigieg. You know, he had said things very much in favor of Medicare for all just as mayor before he ever launched his presidential candidacy. But then, you know, last spring, you could almost see the wheels turning and he kind of realized that it wasn't going to be a very tenable position to be in favor of eliminating most people's coverage. And so he came out with this Medicare for all who want it option,
right,
which is sort of a very clever way of saying, let's have a government plan available to everybody, but the voter gets to choose what they want. Elizabeth Warren has gone a similar direction, but in a little bit of a different way, and a way that I think is actually, you could argue, was politically smart, where, you know, she says she still wants Medicare for all as envisioned by Sanders, this very generous plan. That's her ultimate goal.
Mm-hmm.
But she kind of softened her position a little bit last fall by saying, I'm not going to push for this right out of the gate. What I'm going to try to do initially is just make Medicare available for more people, so people down to age 50, actually, and then introduce a public option plan that people could also buy into. And then once I, you know, hit the third year of my presidency, then I'm going to try to go for Medicare for all. So I think she's kind of trying to, like, walk both sides of that by positioning herself as not quite as revolutionary as someone like Sanders, but also someone who's progressive enough that this is where she wants to ultimately go.
You can promise anything you want when you're on the campaign trail, but if you don't have, well, if you don't run the board, if you don't take the White House, you don't hold the House, and you don't take the Senate, what is the likelihood even of a President Sanders getting this through a Republican-controlled Senate?
Yeah. Well, you know, I've been covering all of the battles over the Affordable Care Act now for almost a decade.
Yeah.
And 10 years out, Congress is still not at a point where it can even agree enough to fix things in the ACA or improve the ACA. Of course, it's looking like Republicans are going to retain control of the Senate. And if they do that, a Democratic president, whether it's Sanders or Biden, is probably going to be largely stuck with trying to undo a lot of the policies that the Trump administration has rolled out in terms of Medicaid and different rules around the Affordable Care Act. A Democratic administration could also work on drug pricing and try to advance some of those things. But I don't ultimately see a situation where you have any kind of seismic shift in the insurance programs that are available to Americans or any big shift in really who's insured or how many people are insured or where their insurance comes from.
Now, Congress did try to take on surprise medical billing, drug pricing. What happened to that?
Oh, that is a real story, I think, of industry influence. You know, last year, there was a lot of optimism at the beginning of the year that we were, that was sort of one area of bipartisanship. And you saw leaders in both the House and Senate saying, we want to make this happen. We saw a big, you know, bipartisan drug pricing bill out of the Senate Finance Committee. We've seen a lot of bipartisan work on the surprise billing issue in the House committees. And there was a lot of talk that some of these provisions would get tacked onto the year-end spending bill in December. But there was a huge, huge opposition, of course, from pharma, which everyone expected, to the drug pricing measures. But what was really surprising is on the surprise medical billing issue, which everyone thought was going to happen, you saw a lot of these doctors groups, a lot of hospitals actually kind of take sides with insurers over how you would fix this problem. And there's sort of different ways to calculate how surprise medical bills would be paid. And the doctors and the hospitals were afraid they were going to get the short end of the stick, and the insurers were afraid they were going to get the short end of the stick. And so at the end of the day, when the lawmakers were trying to sort of hammer out these specific approaches, there was so much advertising and so much pressure from the industry groups that it all seemed to kind of collapse at the end of the year.
One of the images that struck me in the past year and a half were the busloads of people going across to Canada to get their medications just because the prices were so different, right? And that was one of the things that the president said he was going to do, is make it possible for you to buy drugs from Canada. Where's that at now?
Yeah, so this has become a real sore point for Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar. He had really wanted to sort of put his mark on the drug pricing issue. And they have just kind of run up against wall after wall. And, you know, they came out with several policy proposals that were considered very aggressive, especially for a Republican administration. They were going to try to crack down on these drug rebates that are paid that sort of convolute the whole system and push list prices up. They issued a rule requiring drug makers to display the list prices of drugs in television ads. In December, they proposed a rule to allow the importation of some cheaper drugs from Canada. But in many of the cases, not the Canada case, but in many of the other cases, they've either had to walk back because of sort of side effects or industry pressures. They've seen some of the things blocked by the courts, and then some other policies that they had promised haven't actually come to fruition yet. And so now we're at a point where, you know, there's been reports recently that Trump has been really frustrated about the state of affairs. And he spent a lot of the last 2 years promising that drug prices would go down, promising to make his mark on this. And now he's going into this election year with honestly not very much to show for it. And we saw a lot of drug makers hike prices once again this year, something they typically do at the beginning of the year. We saw the House Democrats pass a drug pricing bill in December, but they only got the support of two Republicans for that. And that would have been pretty revolutionary in allowing the federal government to start directly negotiating lower prices, much like what happens in other countries. But of course, that's a non-starter in the Republican-led Senate. So it's a little bit difficult at this point to see where we go from here.
When we talk about health care reform, it really kind of seems like two fronts. One is the expansion to cover more people than have it today, and then the other is to really fix the problems with the system that hundreds of millions of people are on, right? I mean, what's the administration up to in terms of either expanding the roles or perhaps even doing the opposite?
Yeah. So what the administration has done, and of course they, you know, it should be noted, they very much wanted the Affordable Care Act to be repealed and replaced back in 2017. The president had talked
about
that.
That was one of his campaign promises.
And even, exactly. And he even hammered on it last year, even though Congress had really moved on past that and Republicans had indicated they were tired of that effort. So, you know, I think the administration has tried to carve out a niche for itself on expanding alternate forms of coverage. So one of their arguments against the Affordable Care Act has been, okay, more people have health coverage, but it's not affordable coverage, which there is some truth to that, certainly. And so what they've done is they have issued regulations expanding access to some of these short-term limited duration plans and also association health plans. Democrats have sort of taken that and run with them and kind of pointed the pointed the finger and tried to argue that the administration is trying to expand junk plans and all this. So it sort of turned into a political issue. But you see President Trump out there sort of making these big, bold claims, saying that we've suddenly fixed Obamacare and made insurance so much more affordable. And it's important to keep in mind that while they have made sort of these minor changes, they haven't made any major changes to sort of the insurance coverage offerings available to people and the cost of that insurance.
What about the efforts to tie work requirements into Medicaid? That happened kind of on a state-by-state level in a couple of different places. Where's the administration on that?
So that's another big way that the administration is kind of looking to put a more conservative mark on health insurance. You know, Republicans have been frustrated by the Medicaid program for a long time. They've always argued that this is way too expensive for states. And so Seema Verma, who's the head of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, she actually comes from Indiana, where she worked a lot on their program. So 2 years ago, she extended a letter to states inviting them to apply. So the states have to go to the federal government and say, hey, could we have permission to implement these work requirements? About 10 states have done so. CMS has given permission to all of them to go forward with this. But it's, at this point, it's really turned into a big legal battle because courts have blocked these work requirements in almost every state. You know, the heart of the question here is whether what are the key objectives of the Medicaid program? Obviously, the fundamental point of Medicaid is to make sure that people who are low income have access to health insurance. What Seema Verma likes to argue is it should also have the purpose of incentivizing people to find work, to get job training, to volunteer in their communities.
So they're no longer poor and so, they can get off Medicaid.
Exactly. So it, she sees it as a program that is supposed to help give people a hand up. And so this is this is sort of the fundamental dispute about what is the nature of the Medicaid program, and that's what the courts are considering right now.
So how does President Trump deal with health care on the campaign trail going forward this year, considering that there are a couple of key things that he promised that he hasn't been able to do, and there are a couple of things that he kind of has underway?
I can't overstate how tricky this is for him. You know, when you look back at his campaign in 2016, he was riding off of those wins of Obamacare repeal, and this was an issue that voters still believed Republicans would repeal, replace Obamacare, and it played really well for Republicans at the time. Now, 4 years later, obviously he hasn't been able to do that, and he hasn't been able to implement any big changes on drug pricing so far.
And his party is tired of that fight.
And his party, yeah, and so Democrats really probably had the upper hand on health care issues back in 2018 because they talked about this issue of pre-existing condition protections and this lawsuit against the Affordable Care Act. And so the challenge for Trump is going to be to try to flip that script and make sure that he's not the one on the defense about health care the whole time. So far, I haven't really seen what his line is going to be or how he is going to be talking about that. That's probably partly because the Democratic candidates have mostly been going after each other at this point, talking about and arguing about their differences over public option versus Medicare for all. But I think once we have a Democratic nominee, then those discussions between him and whoever the nominee is will probably become clearer, and he'll really have to figure out what is his healthcare message going to be.
Paige Winfield Cunningham, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And finally, we talked earlier about the Middle East, where the Syrian war is still raging, with more than 3 million civilians trapped under bombardment in Idlib, the last opposition holdout against the Assad regime. And that is why documentaries like For Sama are so important, to bring this brutal war back into the public spotlight. It's an amazing story of love and suffering in war-torn Aleppo. Wahed al-Khatib was an ordinary resident there when she picked up her camera as the Arab Spring turned her homeland into rubble. And last night, she and her family took home a BAFTA award. That's the British Academy Film Award for Best Documentary. Here's a clip from the trailer.
Sama. 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 I made this film for you. بدي اياك تفهم شو اللي كنا عم نقاتل مشانه.
بحبك كثير اكثر منك.
اصلا بيضرب كثير اليوم. سما أنا بعرف إنك عم تفهم شو عم بصير. بقدر شوف هالشي بعيونك. ما عم تبكي مثل أي طفل عادي.
It is an amazing film, and Wad told me that she made it so that her daughter, Summer, would know that her parents had stayed and hoped and fought for a different democratic future in Syria.
Every parent in Syria and everyone who lived through the first year and 2 years of the peaceful demonstration, we have that fear that maybe this is will not be really reached to the next generation. So in one part of this, I really wanted to tell her about like what we went through, how we started this revolution and why. And it's not just for Sama, for all the other children of Syria, for all the world outside, really to understand like what we went through as Syrian people dream of freedom.
This is incredible storytelling, which has taken everybody who's seen it by storm and will probably go on to win a huge number of awards and will put Syria in everybody's face again in a very different way. But Assad has won.
This is one of the things, I'm sorry for this, but I wish, like, I would love when someone said, like, Assad won. Like, he will never, ever won. Like, if he won, this is Syria now, it's all, like, destroyed. Thousands of people are being killed, thousands of people in his presence until now. And 6 million refugees around the world. Like, if Assad won, these people all should be back.
Well, you can watch that full interview on our website. And also, For Summer is nominated for an Oscar. That is it for now. You can always catch us online, on our podcast, and across social media. Thanks for watching, and goodbye from New York.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country. Beyoncé and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.